Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
I'm delighted. You hear his dulcet tones there in the background. I'm delighted to welcome back to the show now one of my favourite guests ever, actually. Top 10, definitely. Maybe even top 5.
Nice one.
Actor Robert Sheehan, good afternoon.
Diag Witch. Hello, Brendan. How are you?
Good. So, Robert, we spoke a few months ago about music, but we did touch that day on your life as a meditator as well. And now you just published a book called Playing Dead, How Meditation Brought Me Back to Life. And look, no, I'll be honest, I did think initially, oh, Mr. Hollywood's discovered meditation. This is going to be painful. Yeah. But I really enjoyed it. You know what I've been doing a bit since I read the book? I've been trying to open myself up a bit to let Shakti run through me. Mm. But tell me about Shakti. It's kind of, you liken it to the Holy Ghost, as we would have known it.
Yeah. Shakti is a word I think comes from the Sanskrit language, which is it's a word to describe a kind of universal energy that you can invite into your body. And in the book, I sort of talk about how different cultures around the world call it different things, like mana in Hawaii and ki in Japan and so forth.
Yeah.
And about 2.5-3 years into my meditation, I think I'd become kind of relaxed and porous enough for a sound healing class to kind of knock something, an old emotional residue, loose in me, so that the channels became clear, so that this universal energy started coming into my body in like a really boisterous and overwhelming way, you know.
So we let go and let clear the synapses and everything and let it in.
It's really just as simple as a body's worth of tingles, you know.
Okay.
It's also an energy that's instructable, you know. You can kind of send it to certain parts of your body. Like Wim Hof famously had necrosis in his foot from...
We're not getting into any people healing themselves with Shakti. Let's take the general.
Yeah.
Let's take the generality kind of a nice idea of letting the energy
through. A healing power to it, definitely.
Yeah. So the book is a memoir of sorts. See, people might imagine you were a really confident kid. So I was surprised. You're quite good at, like, I don't know if anxious is the word. You could never fully kind of relax and join in. It sounds like you're one of those kids who thought everyone else had it sussed and you didn't.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think, you know, in the book I sort of say how I craved the company of other people, and but the sort of inherent discomfort, the social discomfort that I felt here and there, not the whole time, but sort of maybe half the time or slightly more than that, was just kind of the tax that I had to pay for the joy of being around other people, yeah.
So you learn to perform and be charming.
Yeah.
Which is probably what a lot of people do, like.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think there was an unconscious effort to conceal the discomfort. That was what I thought my job was, you know. And I think I learned that really young, really early on, and then just kind of... It remained unexamined until I sat down, took a proper look at myself.
Okay, so you're going around with this construct around yourself all the time.
Yeah, which kind of then bled into my approach to acting.
Yeah.
Because, you know, auditions were probably the greatest source of nerves in my adult life, going in and trying to wow these people and sort of be really hireable and go, well, we got to hire this guy. But really, again, I was just trying to suppress a natural sort of anticipatory anxiety reaction to the audition, which was, you know, in hindsight, looking back, the complete opposite way of going at it, you know.
You do say then, which is quite stark, that you decided then that emotions really, what they were good for was as a currency for acting, like.
Yeah. Because I kind of set up a thing in the book where I say that as a kid, my first religious experiences were quite performative. And then my first performative experience was religious. So my first audition, I had this a very unexpected emotional experience where I sort of cried and kind of lost the run of myself and lost all sense of a self.
Yeah.
And had an extremely, you know, I kind of accessed something really real, I think, inside myself unexpectedly in the middle of this kind of performance. And so the fact that that happened in an audition kind of set the wheels in motion for thinking, yeah, that real expressive kind of therapeutic emotional exploration was only valuable in the world of pretending.
and then not in the real world. Keep stunned. So was your emotional growth completely stunted then? Because I presume then if you go into acting and you have success in everything, you're kind of protected in a way that you don't have to grow emotionally.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of, there's a degree of compartmentalization going on to like, on the one hand, I had acting to as a sort of emotional outlet.
Yeah.
That could, you know, could be quite cathartic. But on the other hand, it was compartmentalized over there. You know, it was done only under the studio lights or whatever else. It wasn't done in the real light of day, the emotional
exploration. So the only time you felt like Robert was when you were acting?
Partly, yeah. It was bizarre. It was, yeah.
So then, right, we come to, it was January 10th. 2017, really an important date for you. You're in Portland, Oregon. You're working on a film.
Yeah.
And you realise, you say, you had completely lost the ability to be alone with yourself. Describe that point in your life to me.
Yeah, well, you know, I had a television there. I had some forms of distraction. And I watched a couple of films and I was still sort of climbing the walls, restless. And I thought, this isn't okay, you know. I've been kind of satiating various desires, desire to work, desire to be successful, desire. But really, I realized after, you know, again, retrospectively looking back, that all of the desires that I was trying to satiate were all in pursuit of a sense of peace, you know, and I was looking for that sense of internal peace externally. I was looking for it everywhere where I shouldn't have been looking for it. And I should have been just trying to sit down and look at what was causing the opposite of it within, you know.
It is what the world tells the kids now, isn't it? That, like, you know, fame, success and this stuff, they'll be the answers. Like,
yeah,
you had what every actor wanted, success. Like,
yeah, I was kind of saying to myself, well, this is what I told myself would make me happy, you know, when I was a kid. Yeah. So it was a real case of conditioning, like operant conditioning. I was kind of running towards the thing that had previously given me joy, you know, pleasure. And so I thought that it promised, you know, wholeness, peace, if I kept pursuing it my whole life, you know.
And then if the thing that you thought was going to make you happy and you get it and it doesn't make you happy, you're despairing then, obviously. Like, cause at least before that, you thought, well, I could be happy if I got it. Like, and so you just started meditating kind of freelance, really, didn't you?
Like,
and kind of as an escape, really, was it?
Yeah, it was an escape. You know, it was. At first, it was kind of clumsy, and it was prideful, I think, because part of why I started meditating was that I thought, I don't need therapy. You know, therapy's not for me. Therapy's for other people. You know, which is a silly notion as well. Therapy's for everybody. I'm sure it's very useful, but I sat down and I just started looking around for voices on the internet that could guide me, that I liked. And that's how it started, you know. And it, for about 6 months, it was quite uncomfortable. But then what started to replace the incoherence or the, you know, the sort of passive mind that if you're left undistracted, thoughts start kind of barreling in at you. Mm-hmm. Thoughts that have everything to do with the external and they've everything to do with the future or the past. But after about 6 months to a year, there was a cessation of the rate, you could say, the frequency of thoughts.
Does it settle, it does?
Yeah, it settled down when I sort of started to sit into a kind of a deeper part of my consciousness and earned a lot of spaciousness and peace and wholeness as a result of that.
Okay, so it takes time because most people think, oh, geez, if I sit down, try and meditate, sure, I'm bombarded with thoughts. Like, yeah. But it's like a snow globe, they sometimes say.
Yeah,
you know,
it is like that.
It will if you let it.
100%. Yeah. Because we live, I think the surface part of our minds is conditioned by the external. You know, it's almost a symbolic representation internally of what's going on in our external environment. And our external environment is extremely stimulating. Look at your office. You've got extremely bright walls. You've got how many? 6 televisions, bright lights. It's just, it's imagery
going
flying
on.
Into your unconscious. So when you sit down and the mind becomes undistracted, you're looking at the accumulation of all of that, you know.
So 2019 then is the next kind of crucial point here. So you start playing Klaus in the Umbrella Academy, right? And this was a new level of fame for you, I think. And you basically couldn't handle it, could you?
Yeah, no, I struggled with it. There's a line in the book saying I'm a strange enough bird anyway, and I could feel fame greying my feathers, you know.
Yeah.
Because Netflix's distribution is completely worldwide. There's only about 5 or 6 countries that Netflix isn't in. And Umbrella Academy got a big marketing push. It was brilliant. It became a hit show. But then people's responses to me on the street became very different because of the distribution of the show. You know, my life hadn't changed per se, but the amount of people that I was put in front of changed massively. And so it kind of changed people's reactions. So people became very deferential and very kind of gave me a lot of seniority, strange.
Yeah.
A strange kind of reverence, you know.
It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's to do with, I think, just how many human beings that you're exposed to, you know.
It's bigger than having a big movie or whatever. If something hits on Netflix, like these days, that's like absolute worldwide unhandleable fame.
Global, yeah. And I think
so you can't go anywhere, like.
What started in me, there was a few things that happened with strangers,
like
that I wasn't prepared for. Well, you know, drunkies kind of getting you in a half headlock, going, come here, do a picture with my girlfriend, you know, and sort of being heavy-handed with their energy. And
about you. You're being paid plenty of money to have put up with this. Like, you're not being paid for the acting, you're being paid for that.
Yeah,
kind of nonsense,
and
like.
And I think I started to suffer under the idea that I had to give people what they wanted, or whatever latest whim they were possessed by, was my job to give it to them, you know. So there wasn't enough self-compassion there that came along with the fame. And I think in the absence of self-compassion, the kind of fame narrative in my head started to be, I don't like fame. I don't like how it feels to be in public. And that story took root,
you know,
in the form of confirmation biases. Yeah, you know, I mean, I started to kind of tend towards staying away from crowds and staying away from certain demographics of people where I knew they'd all recognise me. And, you know, I started to kind of limit my life.
And do you have to, if everyone who asks you for a picture, you kind of have to take it. If you don't, you're bollocks, basically, are you? You're
that worse than used to be the story, but now it's not anymore. Now I have to take care of myself before I take care of the needs of other people.
At that point, that would have been the scene.
Yeah, definitely. So, and it wasn't other people's actions that was making me miserable about fame. It was a series of sort of confirmation biases that led to this conclusion that fame was bad. Fame was a danger.
And before we get to how you changed that story.
Oh, yeah.
You do mention, kind of just in passing, really, that friends and family dynamics can change as well when a person becomes famous really quickly. Yeah.
I remember reading something that Paul McCartney wrote, and he wrote about that, how...
And what about for you?
Yeah, you know, I didn't have kind of feverish Beatles fame, but there's enough fame. You know, Ireland's a pretty small place.
But your friends
place.
And your family are even affected slightly, like they see you slightly differently without realising it.
I start to represent something entirely else in their community, and people start talking about me to them, you know, in a very different way. So it starts to affect them directly. And then, you know, for example, my mother works part-time in the local theatre in Portlaoise, in Dunamaze. And, you know, when the young ones found out that she was my mother, you know, they were like, oh, Christ, I can't believe that you're Robert Sheehan's mum. And so it does have a direct and somewhat daily effect on their lives. And so it was new territory for us all to kind of handle.
Yeah. So your answer initially was weed, drink, casual sex.
Yeah.
Did that work?
Different forms of sedation.
Right.
In temporary bursts, it worked. Yeah. You know, it gave me back a social appetite, you know.
Okay. So to be able to go out, like.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Sort of. I think put a sort of a hazy filter on the world so I could go back out, take the edge off of things. And it was a sort of a crutch for a while, you know.
Yeah, because like you use the word addiction issues.
Yeah, I mean, that was what it was, because it was my relationship around, you know, narcotics was not healthy. I was kind of
damaging your life.
I'd say so, yeah.
Managing your relationships.
I think when someone's relationship to alcohol or whatever it is troublesome, you know,
yeah,
then it becomes an addiction issue. You know, it can still go out.
Did you
and
have to knock
drinks.
It on the head?
Yeah, you know, I went through periods of knocking it on the head. I went through periods of, you know, just knocking everything on the head and being silent for a while and kind of retreating from life a little bit in order to meditate a lot and I think own up to the things that I was avoiding, you know.
Stock taking, like.
Yeah, doing a bit of personal work, you know.
Okay. And I did. Tell me about Dinesh then, because you talked about, so you had this narrative of own fame. So Dinesh, he was kind of a guy you met on the street, like, was he kind of a street
yeah,
person?
Yeah.
And you came in, he came into your life then.
Yeah, well, he lived in the same apartment building. And Dinesh is a really interesting, somewhat kind of monastic individual who kind of drifts through the world. He's one of the most unique people I've ever met. And he, you know, is on this earth essentially to do personal work. That's his mission, you
right.
know, is to sort of discover what it is to be a human. And in his case, to be Dinesh, you know.
Yeah.
And so he kind of snapped me out of my negative fame story because...
So you were mourning to him about, oh, it's so hard being famous, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. We were having a game of chess and having a smoke and I was going, I don't know, maybe I should just quit acting, you know, maybe it's... But even if I did quit acting, would it make a difference? Because the genie's kind of out of the bottle at this stage and, you know. And he just went, well, why don't you try accepting it all, man? Have you tried that strategy? And I kind of went, what you... And I in the book, I kind of go, do you ever have that thing where someone says something and you know that it's true and you feel something lurch,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
in your belly? And at first, when I sort of floated the idea of accepting, nay, embracing fame, embracing it and kind of starting from that perspective, it was like it was bumping up against something very solid inside of me. And I thought, wow, this is strange. I've built a wall in myself against the very thing that I've been working my whole life to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a bizarre kind of a hypocrisy that I was living, you know. And I think a lot of famous people fall into that trap when there's a swift change of their situation where people start treating them very differently. People start wanting things from them a lot. And it causes an instinctive recoil at first. And it takes... a readjustment and, dare I say, a practice of acceptance to the new regime in order to find happiness again.
Yes.
Otherwise, you could
they
remain miserable.
They often need Elton John to help them.
Exactly.
But Dinesh was your Elton John.
He was
anyway.
My Elton, exactly.
Yeah. So how did... we'll come to how meditation helped and all that, right? But can I just ask you one thing then? So after that, did you kind of also deliberately step away maybe from a kind of a career that might have invited more massive fame into it? Did you kind of step aside as well as accepting the fame?
No, because I think the acceptance part of it is acceptance 100%.
Okay.
So, you know, I think that the thing with folks sometimes starting out with meditation is they feel that in order to earn space in one direction, they have to impoverish themselves in a different direction. Like a lot of people, I think, are wary of meditation because they think they have to alter their external personality to become Mr. Still or Mr. Guru or Mr. Spaciousness or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, real meditation, in my opinion, is about accepting wholeheartedly and embracing who you are outwards just as much as who you are inwards so that you don't become a sort of a waifish prat, essentially,
yeah, yeah.
you know.
Can you become a bit of a pain in the hole with the meditation initially? Yeah?
Definitely, 100%.
Really,
it
yeah?
happened to me, yeah. There's a bit in the book called Pitfalls
okay.
about some of the negative chapters, some of the negative side effects that I went through meditation. What's that?
Smugness,
yeah. You know, a different form of ego. Once
okay.
a bit of spaciousness was earned, my ego was incredibly, or ego broadly speaking, was incredibly eager to take credit for that spaciousness and go, you know, there's something you can do, you know, to sort of... and talk about enlightenment like some sort of prat, you know. and there's a few quotes, choice quotes that I say in the book about really silly things that I said around the kind of 2018, 2019-ish mark, yeah, to Go people. On. Like I remember saying to my mate, is it Ricky, in my kitchen going, you know, I can literally go some evenings for hours without having a thought. Really stupid, really. And not true either, you know. Just sort of blurting out kind of boastful statements.
But broadly, I think, has it made you easier to be with? Do I get the impression that you might have been a bit hard to be with in a relationship with, like, before?
Yeah. There is a bit at the end where I talk about having gone through stressful relationships, like romantic relationships, and then being scared to go back in the water, being scared to kind of re-explore love with another person. And it wasn't because I was scared of the other person. It was that I was scared of the person that I was when I found myself in a relationship. We all, I think, have not a self, but a series of selves that we use throughout the day. You know, we have a self that we speak to our family with, and we have a self that we use when we're queuing for a bus ticket. You know, that we have different vanishing selves that appear and disappear throughout the day. And the self that I encountered when I was in a relationship was troublesome, and was not a nice person to be. Okay. I think I struggled with that person. And so it took that was the kind of I'd say probably so I talk about that near the end of the book. It's probably the most personal stuff I talk about, because it's the part of myself where I made the most progress, I think, in getting to a place where I could like that person and still be in love, you know.
Yeah. And look, I notice you don't really talk about it, but you seem to be in a fairly settled, happy relationship now, are you?
Yeah.
Good. So then give me the broad picture then, because I think you're coming across as a good old lad for meditation today.
In a very
kind of common sense way. Tell me how it helped you and how it changed you and what it does for you.
Well, when you sit down, the nuts and bolts of it are that you rest your focus in one place. When we're out doing stuff, you know, a lot of people say to me, oh, my meditation is cycling or making things. And that's all well and good, because what it's doing is it keeps the focus on one thing. And when you look at the mechanics of meditation, really all it is keeping the focus, and the focus gets dragged away. And then it's brought gently and lovingly back to the same point. You know, the point might be, you know, the third eye chakra, wherever, you know, or just body
breath,
in general.
Just breath for people is a simple one, isn't it? Yeah.
And when you get better at that, resting the focus in one place, all of a sudden one's entire day becomes more pleasurable, because the focus is not constantly being divided between that screen, that email, that compulsion to send, you know, that thing to that person, and so on and so forth. Like, we're so bombarded by impulse, you know, by the external environments, that when you earn back the power to have an undivided focus, that prolongs the time of your day, literally.
That's really good. So, you know, like, for somebody who thinks this is all a bit woo-woo, right?
Yeah, it's not woo-woo.
All you're saying is it's practicing focus, training your mind to focus and still a bit again, like.
Yeah, and when you do that, you build a greater degree of neurological fluency between you and your body. You get to know the habits of your passive mind, and so that you start to take the thoughts that appear with a bit more of a pinch of salt. You don't dismiss them, but you realise that they're on a certain rudimentary loop. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Sure, the vast majority of thinking we do is junk, like.
It's junk
on a loop all the time.
And it's more helpful.
So it's being a bit more aware of that as well, like seeing it.
That becomes part of the moving canvas of the day. It just becomes another part of it. It becomes like an inner response or an inner flash of colour to whatever's going on in the environment, like the vanishing self
idea.
You're
not in it, you're not caught in the rapids of it all.
Yeah, you're just observing. It's like a sort of an onion of experience, you know, with inner layers moving towards outer. you know.
No, it does sound, though, that you're not a dabbler. Your practice is quite intense, is it?
Well, you know, I'm not, I don't subscribe to having, you know, a specific practice and okay. being quite rigid about that. I like just kind of trying a bit of everything. I like a bit of yoga. I like meditating when I'm cooking, you know. I like meditating when I'm doing stuff, like walking.
How might people build a little bit of it?
A nice way, like, for example, walking, if you're doing something dynamic, a way to meditate is just to repeat a mantra, you know, slowly, and repeating it conceptually or physically into the body. You know, it's almost like I say, like a mantra for me is like a passive thought, but in reverse, you know. So conscious thought is putting a thought out silently into the body and beyond. Mm-hmm. And that way you're stilling the passive monkey brain, you know, you're okay. pausing it for a while you're focusing on chopping or whatever. You're not preoccupied with what you're supposed to be doing next week or what you should have done last week. And then, like, I realized, like, I got better at chopping vegetables. I got better at walking because I realized that I wasn't, you know, walking correctly. That I when I was doing something, I was doing it and studying doing it at the same time, as opposed to just walking just to get somewhere and thinking about where I was going to be in advance, but instead just being walking, you know, and devoting myself to whatever's happening in the moment, I suppose, you know.
Okay, and look, you're at pains to point out in all of this that you're not an expert or anything, but what advice would you offer someone listening who's kind of convinced by this now in terms of getting started?
I'd say no second is a waste of time in meditation. It's all paying into the delicious spaciousness savings account. So give yourself time. Give it time to start to for spaciousness to sort of ripen in
okay.
you. And so that might mean 6 months, a year. And, you know, people often go, oh, you know, I got frustrated with it. And mind was too noisy and I couldn't switch it off. That's a big one. But I'd say the purposes of meditation is not to switch your mind off. It's to listen to your mind and it's to hear it and then eventually replace it with a mantra. And then ultimately, when the mind is replaced, suddenly you're looking out over a vast horizon of spaciousness that contains all these other frequencies. You know, that our consciousness is like a radio. And you can turn the dial, you know, and the more you listen, the more access to different stations you get.
But
you know?
But you are the same you doing the same things 100%. In the same world. You're not going around spaced out or whatever. But it's just that the you in the middle of it is.
Yeah, because you can go to the spaciousness place. But then when you come back to daily life, I set a little intention, like I had a little meditate before coming in here in the waiting room.
Yeah.
And I made sure at the end of it to go, now go in there and be conversational with Brendan. Don't go in there in a meditative state because it's not the right mode of consciousness to go on the radio.
You did that once at a film premiere, didn't you?
Yeah. There's a bit I said in the book where I was going into the premiere of the film Mortal Engines and I thought, it'd be cool if I do a nice deep meditation in the car on the way to the premiere. Yeah. But what I didn't do was kind of set a sort of social mode intention before going onto the red carpet. So I was sort of wafting onto the red carpet, still in a deep meditative state.
With entertainment TV shoving microphones in your face.
Going, tell us about the movie. I was going, I don't know. I had no access to my social self, you know. So just stick with it, I'd say. Yeah. Stick with it. Give it 6 months to a year and then judge to see how it's going.
You're very good at this. Do you think this is something you're going to pursue a little bit in being an advocate for this and stuff?
It'd be a great thing to be an advocate for because I think a lot of the actions of people come from unconscious, I loathe to use computational words, but unevaluated, previously sort of established modes of behavior or software, you know. that get people into trouble, you know, like things that we learn when we're kids that ultimately still govern certain aspects of our behaviour.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that is misunderstood. So meditation
is about... So it's freed you up from a lot of that.
Yeah, it has, yeah. I think. Yeah, it kind of rewards you agency, a lot of agency in your life, in all of the environments, even the ones where you relinquish control and might have become emotionally hijacked, you know, like me in a relationship before.
Okay. So I'd say the bullet point kind of, or the line for the poster would be meditation made me less of an asshole.
Yeah, made less of an impulsive twat.
Okay, very good. Yeah. So listen, tonight are you doing this event in...
In the Dáil bike sheds, yeah. Yeah, no, in the Gate Theatre.
The Gate Theatre, okay.
Doing a book talk, so I'm doing a promotional tour to... You know.
Okay, and you are also, you're hosting a guided meditation, I believe, as part of a book launch at the Set Theatre in Kilkenny.
I have a fella called...
On Tuesday.
I have a fella called Dara and a woman called Margaret who are running the meditation guides for the gigs because
Excellent.
I don't feel like I'm at a stage where I can, you know...
Okay.
I'm not a meditation practitioner, I'm still a student.
So you'll talk a little bit about your journey and then everybody will do a meditation together.
Yeah, we'll do a Q&A in the middle of that too so people can kind of, you know, ask whatever questions they want and see and have a kind of a two-way chat, you know.
Great. Well, listen, people are receiving you very well here in the text. Oh, you know what I'd say it is? I'd say a lot of people have preconceptions about you. Because you're beautiful and because you're an actor, we're very hard on beautiful actors, but actually, you're not what they expected at all.
I'll take that.
Playing Dead is the book, and it's a terrific read. It's published by Ryder Books, and it's out now. Robert Sheehan, it was great to see you again. I hope I see you back here again soon.
Thanks for having us, Brendan. Appreciate you.